Thanks for attending Multnomah Group's webinar today on full scope versus limited scope audits and retirement plans. My name is Eric Daly. I'm a managing principal of the Multnomah Group, and I'm going to cover a handful of topics related to the retirement plan audit process and hopefully provide some context. Before I jump into the agenda, however, a few housekeeping items. I apologize for my nasally voice. I've contracted a cold, and I'm having a hard time shaking it, at least the last residual effects of it. I apologize if I'm a little foggy-minded as a result, but I'll try and be clear and concise in my remarks today. However, to the extent that I don't do a good job of that, please do feel free to ask questions throughout the presentation, and we'll certainly address as many of those as we have time for over the course of the hour that we have scheduled. You'll notice in your dialog box from a housekeeping item that you can submit questions in writing. We will try and address those either throughout the presentation or at the conclusion of the presentation. Additional housekeeping items, all of your lines have been muted so that you can hear my nasally voice more clearly, but also to make the call more easily understood by the participants. Last housekeeping item, we will be sending a copy of today's presentation shortly after the conclusion of the presentation today, and then over the next few days, as we clean up the audio and review it, we'll be presenting a copy of the full recorded presentation if there are items that you wish to review from the audio portion of our presentation. So with that, I'm going to jump into the agenda briefly. We're going to talk about the retirement plan audit process and what the requirements of that process are and really the benefits that the audit process brings. I think, you know, frequently in the retirement plan space, we think of audits as being this necessary evil. But if we go back and kind of understand the origins of retirement plan audits and why the Department of Labor is so interested in the retirement plan audit process, it helps reveal the benefits and insights that a well-run audit process should provide plan sponsors and the fiduciaries who carry such tremendous legal liability for running their retirement plan. We'll talk about the Department of Labor's seemingly escalating concerns about the audit process and specifically about limited scope audits. And then we'll do a little bit of compare and contrast. You know, the data supports that about 70% of plans use some form of limited scope audit. Only about 30% of plans use a full scope audit. And we'll talk about the differences and potential limitations and pitfalls of both full scope and limited scope audits. And then back in 2012, the Department of Labor issued yet another report on audits and audit process, and we'll talk about what that audit process revealed and recommendations that you as plan sponsors may take considering what the Department of Labor detected in that effort. There's who I am. I work out of our Portland location, consulting directly with clients. To the extent that you have issues related to retirement plans, please feel free to email me separately or independently, and we're more than happy to go back and provide some additional information. To help provide some additional context to today's presentation at any point in time. So let's talk about the audit requirement process first. So the retirement plan audits are primarily a issue related to plans covered by the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. The necessity for audits was kind of written into the original outline of ERISA back in 1974. ERISA Section 104A requires all plans subject to ERISA to file an annual report. That's that Form 5500 that so many of us enjoy. And as part of ERISA, it said that certain plans are required to receive an independent qualified public accounting position to review generally accounted auditing standards and to perform tests on plan operations. Those are outlined under the body of ERISA. However, at the same point in time, the regulators in their infinite wisdom provided what seemed to be a very reasonable opportunity to try and mitigate the cost associated with that independent audit. And that was under Section 103A3C, which provided the option for a limited scope audit for qualifying plans. And qualifying plans allow auditors to rely on investment information that's been certified by a bank or insurance carrier because those assets that are held by the bank or held by the insurance carrier are already subject to very stringent governmental audit and regulation standards. So as a result, rather than have every plan sponsor have to audit the particular outline, this gives them the opportunity to rely on already existing auditing practices to ensure that plan holdings. I understand that we're having some technical issues related to slide transitions currently. So give me a second as we try. I'm looking at a slide that apparently many of you are not able to see yet. So let me see if we can't get that fixed really quickly here. Looks like we have hopefully resolved the issue. So this is the first of the content slides. You missed my biography and all that wonderful stuff, but you'll get that in the reported materials that come back. But essentially said, hey, rather than have every plan sponsor with 150 participants go through the process of having to audit a bank, an insurance company to determine that their assets are there, because those entities are already regulated, banking regulators, the Securities and Exchange Commission, state and federal insurance regulators, why don't we allow the auditors to say that the data that's provided by these custodial entities escapes the bounds of the audit process? However, that doesn't extend to money coming in or out of the plan. So any contributions still need to be audited under this limited scope audit. Any benefit payments still need to be audited that come out of the process. All of that data continues to be available and part of the limited scope audit process. And I know there are some government-sponsored plans, some church plans as well on today's call. While the requirements of audit extend from the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, it is very common, frankly, for plans not subject to ERISA to also engage in a process, because ultimately, this retirement plan audit is conducted for the benefit of plan participants. The intent in its being drafted into ERISA was to provide participants who are relying so heavily on these retirement plans to assure their future ability to retire the comfort that an independent auditor has validated and confirmed that the assets that are being reported and purported for their benefit are actually there and available. And will be there by the time they get to retirement. So while these regulations are requirements of ERISA, other plan sponsors that want to provide that same level of oversight and fiduciary governance to plan sponsors have the ability to do so by conducting either a full limited scope audit or some variance thereof because they have a greater deal of independence in how they go through their audit process if it's not prescribed by the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. There are some critical benefits, clearly, of the retirement plan benefit audit process. Primarily, the one that I mentioned previously is this assurance to plan participants that the records are being properly maintained, right? That when I log into my account or I receive my benefits statement from my provider, if it says that I have $162,000 as of September the 30th of 2014, that I can have comfort and reliability that at least as of September 30th of 2014, that $162,000 is there. It also provides comfort that the financial statements of the plan have been examined. So when we're paying expenses or paying benefits or allowing loans, that those are accurately being reflected in the value of the plan. And perhaps more importantly, from a participant and plan sponsor perspective, is that these plans have sound plan operating practices. How does the plan ensure that their contributions are being made to the trust or custodial account in an accurate, reasonable, and timely manner? And frankly, how do we control or have some oversight over the potential fraud that could be incurred for a plan sponsor and those who are dealing with the cash transactions related to the plan, that they're being done accurately and in accordance with the plan document? The Department of Labor has relatively early had concerns about the limited scope audit process. Back in 2010, the Department of Labor formed an advisory council to study employee benefit plan auditing practices and financial reporting models, and they revealed some troubling concerns, at least from their perspective, troubling concerns about the limited scope audit process. And really, they fell into four particular areas where they felt there was massive misunderstandings about the use of limited scope audits. When they talked to plan sponsors and practitioners, there seemed to be a tremendous misunderstanding about what issues were to be audited under the terms of a limited scope audit. The second is that there was some considerable concern and consternation and frankly misunderstandings as it related to which types of entities can offer asset certifications. So back to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, the only way a plan sponsor can opt out or opt into a limited scope audit is if the custodian who holds the assets on behalf of plan participants can certify that asset statement. And back to my prior comment, only banks and insurance companies are able to provide that asset certification, but frankly, entities that didn't share that level of regulation were quote-unquote certifying asset statements, and therefore the plan sponsors, based on that certification, were engaging in limited scope audits. The significance of the certifications with regard to asset valuation and the audit. So ultimately, when you're conducting a retirement plan audit, one of the critical things the auditor is trying to get to is determining whether the assets reported in the filing match the assets that are actually available. And that becomes more difficult in an environment where there may be assets that are difficult to value. And frankly, many custodians, especially if they don't carry marketable securities like mutual funds or stocks, provide a certification using the most recently reported price, which may not reflect, frankly, what the current price is. So private real estate transactions, limited partnerships, all of those tend not to be marketed or marked to market each day and therefore reflected in the custodial statement. However, in many instances, they were part of the certification process, and therefore additional audit steps weren't being taken on those assets. And currently this continues to be a problem, certainly was back in 2010 as well. Plan sponsors really failed to understand the importance of the limited scope audit and what issues the limited scope audit was intended to resolve for them and for their participants as beneficiaries of the plan. Limited scope audits in the current environment. So the limited scope audit provisions come from back in 1974. Ultimately, much has changed since 1974. If you go back to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act at its outset, many of the plans at the time were defined benefit pension plans. So ultimately, their ability to provide benefits was as much an actuarial exercise as it was an accounting exercise. Are the assumptions strong? Are the assets to back up these future liabilities present? And how can we provide that environment? The other critical difference from 1974 to today is when you looked at the securities, most of the securities being held in plans were readily marketed and available in the open market. They were either mutual funds or they were individual stock securities. And therefore, you didn't have the prevalence that we do today of difficult to identify an asset value securities within plans. If you look across the retirement plan marketplace, especially on ERISA plans, 401k plans, defined benefit plans, you are seeing a massive proliferation in limited partnerships, in private equity funds, hedge funds, which have been much written about certainly over the course of the last month with CalPERS announcing that they were going to be divesting from their hedge fund population. All of those carry significant differences that make them more difficult to value than certainly the securities that were more prevalent in 1974. The second issue that we've seen is that back in 1974, the custodians generally held paper securities for each of the assets that they had in their control. And that is very, very different from the custodial arrangements that we see today, where ultimately the custodian may be a bank or insurance company, but ultimately those banks and insurance companies don't actually possess any securities at all. What they have is electronic book entries that show that there are assets, and they're receiving data sometimes from entities that would not be subject to the qualifying security regulations. So if they're getting their data from a clearinghouse or from brokers or other non-qualified institutions, the fact that the data, the technology, and the ledger happens to be a bank or insurance company may provide a risk environment for plan sponsors who are relying on the limited scope audit. And then the prior issue that we talked about, which is that many custodians hold securities at the issuing value. And to the extent that you're using products that aren't in the open marketplace, ultimately those are being reflected by changes in value each day. And the custodians who aren't responsible as directed custodians to the plan for maintaining those values may be providing certifications that don't actually reflect the current value, but instead the historical purchase value of the securities that are out there. So those are the three things that have changed relatively materially from 1974, the types of securities and, frankly, the type of custodial transaction environment that plans face today versus what was available back in 1974. I'm going to talk a little bit about full scope and limited scope audits because limited scope audits are the overwhelming proportion of the marketplace. As I mentioned, about 70%. Only about 30% go through this full scope audit. Let's talk about where those differences are and why the Department of Labor does have some concern about how this practice operates. And the first is, and the one probably that is most troubling to audit committees when they review the results of these audits, is does the auditor provide an opinion on the plan's financial statement? So in a full scope audit, the kind that the Department of Labor certainly seems to prefer, you will receive either an unqualified, qualified, or adverse opinion on the plan's financial statements. And that is because the auditor has been instructed to validate and verify that the assets that are reported on the financial statement actually exist on behalf of the plan. The difference in a limited scope audit is that you have a disclaimer of opinion, which says, you know, we can't provide a qualified or unqualified opinion on these assets. And for audit committees who routinely have other aspects of their business audited, that type of disclaimer can be disconcerting, but it is obviously industry standard in a limited scope audit where an auditor has not been instructed to go through that level of detail. And it falls under this next item, does the auditor audit plan investments? So in a full scope audit, yes, they're supposed to audit those assets for completeness and accuracy. And in a limited scope audit, no. We're saying the plan sponsor, in this case being we, that we have a certified asset statement from a qualified custodian, again, a bank or insurance company, and therefore you need not validate that the $10, $20, $50, $200, $2 billion in that custodial account is really there. You just need to monitor the outside transactions into and out of those assets. However, it is important to point out, and one of the things that came out of the original advisory group on these limited scope audits, is there have been some pretty significant changes. And one of them relates to this third item, which is requiring plan sponsors to address these hard to value assets. I think prior to FAS 157, under the limited scope audit, there wasn't necessarily a requirement that plan sponsors went through the process of determining in a hard to value asset environment that the asset values that were being certified were reasonable. Always was true in the full scope audit. The good news now in the limited scope audit is that plan sponsors do need to provide some level of information that helps verify, certainly to plan participants, but also to the plan sponsor, that there is a reasonable practice in place to maintain and determine the asset values of hard to value assets within the retirement plan holding. Last set of issues, does the audit scope include the testing of participant records, contributions, benefit payments, certainly internal controls and reporting on the financial statements? In both cases, yes. Again, the significant difference in the limited scope audit is that in the certified asset, the auditor is not reviewing what's happening to those assets once they're in the custody and control of the bank and or the insurance company. So they're watching money come in, they're watching money come out, they're certainly addressing the reporting and internal control constraints internally and externally, but not evaluating what's happening at the custodial side with the vendors that you may be using there. Same's true on the fraud evaluation side. So one of the material things that an audit practice provides is the ability for plan sponsors to ultimately determine that there's no fraud on the side of the plan sponsor. Pretty important. This is an area, frankly, where fraud can and does occur. And it occurs materially, frankly, in cases that fall underneath that 100 participant and therefore are subject to no audit restrictions. We unfortunately have seen too frequently cases where payroll or benefits managers in those smaller organizations are able to defraud participants on the transactions in, and they've been written about certainly in the newspaper as they get revealed. The evaluation in a limited scope audit for fraud is really the same as it is in the full scope, except again that any fraud that's occurring on the side of the bank or the insurance company, which should be again subject to other regulators, isn't being tested independently by the plan's auditor. And then last, the audit identify any internal controls, compliance, or operational issues. Absolutely, full scope audit should determine that. The same would be true in a limited scope audit, again, except for any internal control issues or compliance issues that are happening at the custodial side, which you would hope and expect are being addressed and reviewed by the various banking and insurance regulators responsible for providing those protections to all relevant investors, not just retirement plans. So when the ERISA Advisory Council came together, they said, well, where are there opportunities to ultimately kind of improve the quality of limited scope audits? Because they've been around since 1974. They apparently will be around for some time to come. They are routinely endorsed by a number of different entities that believe, frankly, as we do, that it would be financially disadvantageous to the retirement marketplace if every single independent retirement plan were required to audit the bank or insurance company that's holding their assets, that should be done collectively, not at an individual plan level. But the opportunities to improve the limited scope audit that the ERISA Advisory Council came up for was interesting. I think one of the things that they reported that there was a deficiency of specific material evidence of participant harm caused by limited scope audits. That part I think is true. I think in doing research, both related to our short white paper on this topic and in today's presentation, it's really difficult to find a single instance where the limited scope audit somehow harmed participants. Therefore, cases where a full scope audit would have detected something that a limited scope audit did not, and therefore the participants who had the protection of only a limited scope audit were in somehow harmed. And I think that even the Department of Labor, who has been arguably or perhaps even inarguably campaigning Congress pretty heavily to remove this limited scope exemption for retirement plans, have had a hard time identifying those specific areas of harm. I think there is unquestionably a broad level of incompetence, especially among smaller firms that do a smaller volume of retirement plan audits that may provide that opportunity in the future, but they're very, very difficult to find at this point in time. The Council did certainly issue a set of recommendations to the Department of Labor to increase the quality. And some of those have been taken, and the most notable really was the steps that the AICPA took in issuing financial reporting accounting standards, FAS 157, which for many plan sponsors I know was difficult, but it did provide much greater insight into ensuring that the asset values being reported by certified custodians and non-certified custodians, that the assets being held were being accurately reflected, and if there were any assumptions that went into determining those asset values, that those were being disclosed in the audit process, and therefore participants had more insight into evaluating the quality of the asset reporting that they may individually be receiving as participants. So the Department of Labor, in following up on that advisory committee, actually conducted their own study back in 2012. The EBSA issued a report called Changes Are Still Needed in the ERISA Audit Process to Increase Protections for Employee Benefit Plan Participants. And their key findings is really that, you know, since the inception of ERISA, there's been a relatively significant decline in the use of full scope audits in favor of limited scope audits. So if you look at the last, you know, 15 years, we've gone from maybe less than 50% using limited scope to over 70%. We've seen assets subject to full scope, limited scope audit procedures increase from $520 billion to $3.3 trillion. We'll make that correction over the same period of time. And their set of recommendations, frankly, followed very similar to the ones that were addressed in the 2009 independent study. And that really is that they need to use, they being the Department of Labor, their existing authority to clarify and strengthen the limited scope audit regulations. While they continue to campaign really against the limited scope audit exemption with Congress, and that they needed to develop better enforcement tools. Ultimately, the Department of Labor has very limited enforcement to really zero enforcement over these independent qualified public accountant institutions. However, they've become much better at referring bad auditors to their local CPA chapters to allow them to manage the enforcement process. You know, clearly the Department of Labor, as you look at the extension really of what it means to be a fiduciary, would love to have more oversight of these independent qualified public accounting institutions, thereby giving them the authority to mete out punishments and penalties directly rather than have to do it through these independent societies. They certainly want to improve procedures in audit quality reviews, and they've begun the steps to do that currently. And I think we'll talk about some of the interesting things that that process has revealed if you look back over the 2010 and 2011 filing years. And they've begun this process to address a statistically valid review of employee benefit plan audit quality. There is a great concern to the Department of Labor that there are perfunctory audits being conducted but that the real intent of the audit regulations is being missed, and that frankly, that there is a growing risk to plan participants, certainly as these assets grow at such a rapid rate. And it really gets to this particular issue. And I had an opportunity to talk to one of the agents who used to be a CPA who works for the Department of Labor. And her work at the Department of Labor is solely oriented around reviewing audit quality. So she gets cases where there are clearly challenges or problems in the audit process, and she does full examinations, not just of the plan, but in those cases of the audit practice as a whole. And when you look at the Department of Labor's review in 2012, they said, and I quote, that their highest risk for deficient audits were by audit firms who performed less than 25 EB audits a year. This particular group performed a vastly higher level of deficient audits proportionately than firms that did a much higher volume and therefore had kind of reliable, repeatable practices and tended to have a more mature audit review process. For instance, going back to 2010 and 2011 fiscal years, the EBSA spent 70% of their time reviewing these types of firms doing less than 25 EB audits, despite the fact that these firms did less than 25% of all plan audits. So disproportionately, the Department of Labor is having to spend their time dealing with audit firms that do a very narrow volume of audit work, and therefore are providing plan sponsors lower quality, higher risk audit processes. So I know always for plan sponsors, it's certainly tempting to work with firms that are less costly on the audit side. And I think that can be done so long as those firms are less costly because of the efficiencies built into a large retirement plan audit practice. You know, the reality is, in choosing to partner with firms with less experience, given what the Department of Labor's concerns are, I think you actually escalate pretty dramatically the likelihood of your plan being pulled from an audit. Because in talking to the auditor last spring, what was really clear is that when they determine that a particular audit firm has a poor audit practice, they are more likely then to pull additional audits of their clients to determine where there may be additional concerns that need to be remedied. So in working with a one-off auditor, you may actually increase the likelihood that your plan gets pulled by the Department of Labor for independent audit practice. You know, a few recommendations that we make coming out of the data that's available, and let me make really, really clear, we think that if plan sponsors understand limited scope audits and they have good auditors, that in the overwhelming majority of cases, limited scope audits provide the necessary and reasonable protections to plan participants, and that frankly other organizations in aggregate should be responsible for auditing the practices of financial institutions and custodians rather than have independent plan sponsors be responsible economically for doing that, which certainly would increase the cost of providing retirement benefits to participants. So we think and certainly hope that despite the Department of Labor's concerns, that the evidence purports that these limited scope audits done well provide adequate protections. But I do think there are some things that come out of their studies that plan sponsors should be aware of. And perhaps first is that you will only get an audit, a good audit, if you partner with a competent and practiced IQPA, independent qualified public accounting firm. The good news is the Department of Labor actually put together some very good documentation on the practice that plan sponsors should go through to evaluate, retain independent qualified public accounting firms for retirement plans, and we've included a link here. It is important, especially in limited scope audits, there are lots of tests being done by auditors of participant data on the inbound and outbound side. I think it's important for plan sponsors to partner that with a review of the SSA 16 report from your asset custodian, because ultimately once the data gets to the custodian, what that SSA 16 report says is, well, once it's at the custodian, how effectively does the custodian manage it to ensure there are no issues and problems? And frankly, the benefit of partnering your audit with a review of that SSA 16, it should allow you to see where things you are doing may potentially lead to issues or challenges. So if you're submitting data in a format X, and format X is not covered in the SSA 16 audit of your asset custodian, that means that there's a risk point there. And certainly knowing that risk point and perhaps remedying it provides better protections and a more reliable audit process for your plan. Third, understand how all the current values of assets are determined. I know that the independent accounting firms are typically very, very good at helping plan sponsors evaluate, determine what types of asset valuation methodologies should be used when you have securities that are not traded in an open marketplace. And when auditors are doing that work, I think it's equally important that plan sponsors go to the trouble of making sure that they understand that information and that they could articulate it in the case that the Department of Labor were to come in and audit their plan. You know, ultimately, it is the responsibility of the plan sponsor to determine that those asset values that are being reported by the custodian are reasonable and that you've got a process to determine their reasonability. Fourth, have the audit report reviewed with the governing fiduciary group. Again, these audits are not for the benefit of the plan sponsor, although there are a number of plan sponsor benefits and certainly understanding how your internal accounting practice works. They're really for the benefit of plan participants. And as a result, one of the places that it should be reviewed, and there may be many, but one of them is with the governing fiduciary group, the committee that oversees plan operation, because there will be issues that are revealed through that process and potentially opportunities to improve plan operating practice and address areas where there may be risk in the future to the plan fiduciaries. And then at the end of the day, you have to determine which audit structure provides the necessary assurance about your plan's health. There are certainly differences in cost, and depending on your structure, that will impact how different those costs are. And then certainly looking at the types of assets you hold, the type of custodian you're partnering with, and ultimately what's the level of risk. And can that risk be mitigated best in a full scope audit, or can it be mitigated through a limited scope audit with some additional control procedures to ensure that the gaps are removed in the audit process? So that's the discussion that I wanted to have today once I got the technology sorted out. That said, I'm going to take some questions that we received over the course of the presentation today. First question, does a church plan who chooses to participate in this type of limited scope audit and chooses, does a church plan who chooses to participate in this type of limited scope audit, who then chooses not to participate in such an audit in the future, open itself to liability by its participants? And I think the answer there is no. The audit in the case of a church plan would be an optional audit, and there is no case law or practice procedure that says once you've done it, you need to continue to do it. I think it's a great practice to periodically, even if you are exempted from the requirement. I know that a number of institutions do choose to do them once every 2 years or once every 3 years to ensure that they stay on top of the practice, but then can limit their costs by not engaging in the audit each year. So no, I don't think that by conducting it in 1 year and not in another, it opens its liability. Frankly, I think you'd be in a better position by saying that you do them on a regular basis, whatever that regularity may be. Uh, Another question. Should we review the audit report with the governing fiduciary group only when there's comments that come with the audit? And I think the answer from my perspective is no. I would want to see that report reviewed with the governing group in either case. I think in the majority of cases, well, maybe it's 50-50 in my experience, but in half the cases there's no material findings, in half the cases there's a couple of small material findings. In either case, I think it's good for the fiduciary governing group to be able to record in their minutes that they've reviewed it, that they understand it, that they're able to ask the auditors questions about the practice, which I think is important. I think as frequently as possible, we like to see the auditors actually attend a committee meeting to go through those results, even if it's only for 5 or 10 minutes, so that the governing fiduciary group has that opportunity to ask questions and feel a higher sense of comfort that their liabilities as fiduciaries are being reviewed in this audit practice on behalf of participants. Another question, yeah, most of the audit reports are clean without any comments, and I think that's true. I mean, even with the expansion of limited scope audits to address more issues, as plans mature, the number of findings in the audit practice and the audit side tend to decline. They do tend to pop up when there are changes to payroll practices, when there's changes in personnel or staff that are addressing issues. Those two issues tend to have a very high correlation to audit findings. But frankly, once issues are identified, as long as the systems and people stay in place, those same issues tend not to reoccur. And I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons that plan sponsors can periodically grouse about retirement plan audit fees. Is their perspective is, I get the report, and the report says everything's fine. And I understand that, obviously, extending financially to receive an opinion that says everything fine seems kind of anticlimactic, but at the same point, it's certainly better than getting an audit report that says there are material issues that need to be resolved. So the fact that the audit report is clear is a good thing, especially it's a good thing if you have a qualified independent public accounting firm, because unfortunately, and this is certainly what the Department of Labor has found, that there are a whole lot of clean opinions being issued on plans that are, in fact, not clean. But that's happening, again, in cases, frankly, where the audit procedures, limited scope or not, are not adequately addressing the requirements of the Employer Retirement Income Security Act. Any additional questions? Well, thank you. I really appreciate your attendance. Apologize for our, or I shouldn't say our, since they're really mine. My technology issue to start the day. To the extent that you have issues, please do feel free to email me or someone from our team. Again, you'll be getting a copy of the full presentation here shortly. But if I'm going through that, some additional questions pop to mind, we'd be more than happy to address those. Have a great day, and again, thanks for attending.